and welcome back to Go Nuts, the monthly NNGA podcast. I'm here with the wonderful Michael Judd, who has a new book out called For the Love of Pawpaws, a mini manual for growing and caring for pawpaws from seed to table. And I have to say, this book is absolutely gorgeous. The pictures in here are wonderful. It's just such a wonderful resource. So while we get started here, can you introduce yourself to our audience and tell us a little bit about yourself?
I'm Michael Judd. I'm originally from Appalachia, Frederick, Maryland area. But I spent nearly 18 years of my life living in rural Latin America, in the tropics, growing all manner of tropical palms and bamboos and fruits and nuts and just perennial agriculture in general. But my roots are here and I'm back in Maryland. I've started a family, built a circular straw bale house, starting food forest. We just had our fourth annual Pawpaw Festival here. Our place is called Long Creek Homestead. So rerooting life here and celebrating what grows well. And that's certainly the pawpaw in our area.
Absolutely. Well, welcome back. I'm from Northeast Ohio myself, so the Appalachia region, and pawpaws grow great here. So it's nice to see one of America's only native fruits in the region becoming more and more popular. And we're happy as quote-unquote growers to have pawpaws into our group. So as we were talking kind of before we get started, I guess the first question I'll ask just to kick us off here is, why pawpaws? What are your interests in pawpaws and kind of how did you get started with those?
So one of my ongoing focuses is on perennial agriculture, sort of overlapping with permaculture and agroforestry. And this journey for me in this lifetime began about 25 years ago when I was living in the Lacandon jungle, which is the last stretch of rainforest jungle between southern Mexico and Guatemala. And I had gone in to live temporarily with one of the last of the Lacandon tribes. These were the Mayans that had sort of escaped the conquistadores and retreated into the heart of the jungle. And I was barely accepted in as an outsider, but I was drawn in to help create compost toilets because I'd heard that there was a lot of challenges and issues with intestinal problems with a lot of the children in the community because they'd been, the forest is getting cut down. So their traditional spread out community was becoming condensed. And in the rainforest, everything cycles very quickly. So that's what drew me in. And unbeknownst to me, I was entering into a completely different realm of humanity in relationship to its environment. So when I first got there, it just looked like a wild jungle. And the more time I spent there, and I got to work and live with the Mayans and building this compost toilet from the jungle, right? So we'd go out and we would, we would harvest the canes for building the walls. We would make the adobe. We'd go find the palms. We would take the old vines and strip them and, use that for tying everything together. And I got to see in this experience that as a species, as humans, that we can interact with our environment in a way that provides all the things that we need for building, for eating, for medicinals, for fodder for our animals, for crafts, for everything, and it stay regenerative in the sense that it would stay healthy and thriving. So I got to see what looked like a wild jungle being, intimately worked with in a way that supported the people in the land. So that changed my life. That right there was what redirected the rest of my life in understanding that this is actually something possible, not something I'd read about or philosophized about, but like, wow, this we can do this. So, you know, bringing that back to North America, you know, it's a bit of a wake-up call. I was like, okay, I know this is true, but look at everything around us. Look at this, you know, suburban built environment. But fortunately, about the same time, I discovered permaculture. Again, this was like 25 years ago, when Earth Haven's a permaculturally designed community in North Carolina, near Asheville. And when I showed up, they were just starting and building their community center. And I didn't really know what permaculture was. I was drawn in to do some more natural building. I'd kind of gotten the taste and excitement for doing that, living with the Mayans. And so I was drawn in to help work on this circular straw bale, you know, round wood timber frame design that's the community center at Earth Haven. And so I jumped in on that project. And again, all around me, you know, the humans were interacting with their environment in a way that was really regenerative. And so this was kind of the sort of the North American, the cultural equivalent of what I was experiencing with the Mayans. So it was a great combination of experiences back to back that I could relate, you know, to where I've grown up from, you know, here in North America, and you know, on the edges of suburbia. And so that's been my journey ever since. I've bounced back and forth living in Latin America, living in North America, you know, doing, you know, biodynamics when I had the chance, doing arid lands farming, working with just all kinds of tropical and temperate, you know, trees and species, and just looking at all the guilds and combinations, and just being like, and trying to be creative in the understanding of how do these things work, you know, culturally? You know, how can we make these things sort of take root through popular culture, you know, whether it be in rural Latin America or in suburban, you know, USA? And that's really where I find myself a lot, is those crossroads of culture, ecology, and economy. You know, so my designs are always trying to factor those together. And I spent at least 12 years living in rural Nicaragua. I started a grassroots nonprofit there called Project Bonafide in 2001, with the focus on creating long-term food security and also creating niche markets through, you know, perennials. And in permaculture, we observe, we say, okay, what's doing well in this environment naturally, and then, you know, work with those energies. So down in Nicaragua, the mangoes were just, they were just glut. They just did so well. But there was only one sort of, you know, naturalized, you know, species that would drop its fruit just 1 month of the year, and they were small and stringy. And so I was like, okay, well, they're doing well here. How about we look around the tropical belt and start to collect different varieties and cultivars of mangoes, and let's create, you know, more food security. So it's not just 1 month a year that these mangoes are dropping. And then on top of that, let's create a market niche, you know, so that people in the rural areas that are starting to use some of their slash and burn fields to grow some, you know, mangoes can start to get the perennial benefit. So that's just a small example. But I'm getting the pawpaws. I'm getting there. So
this is all very fascinating. So keep on going.
I know. Pawpaws. I'm getting there. So, but during my time living in the tropics, and especially there in Nicaragua, where I did my longest stint of really, really connecting and growing a lot of tropical species, I was growing custard apples. I was growing biriba, which is like a Brazilian custard apple in the same family, the Annona family. The soursop, which is in the Annona family, and even the langlang, the beautiful smelling flower, and all of these tropical relatives of the pawpaw I was growing and celebrating and really appreciating because they were just so tough and exquisitely delicious, right? So I was already getting turned on, you know, to this whole family that the pawpaw is in by living down there. And so, okay, let's speed ahead. And I come back to living in the U.S. I guess I came back about 8-9 years ago and rerouted here in Maryland. So we're in the Blue Ridge Mountains here of the Appalachians, and it's a wonderful climate. We're about zone 6B, 7. We get really good rainfall, upwards of 50 inches, pretty well spread out throughout the year. We have a lot of hollers, you know, sort of valleys, and, you know, sort of little mountain hollers, which is perfect pawpaw country. They really love this humidity. They like the protection from strong winds. As long as they have good drainage, they really thrive here. So as I come back into this environment and I'm looking around, I'm like, okay, what's doing really well here? Because I don't want to have to do a whole lot of extra work. I don't need to. I've learned this from doing all these other observations and working with permaculture and growing systems to know this stuff is real. So I'm looking around me, and there's quite a few things that are jumping out. But then the pawpaw, I mean, here it is. It's growing wild. I mean, it grows wild all around us. I mean, everywhere in our woods, along the highways, along the roads. It's hard not to be able to find a pawpaw in any of the woods around us, you know, and even going into southern Pennsylvania and in Virginia. This is really prime pawpaw country. So I'm seeing that, but largely I'm not really seeing it being interacted with. You know, I see a lot of native plant enthusiasts, you know, talking about it, et cetera, but nobody really kind of, okay, well, how do we work with this? How do we as a species interact with that species and, you know, bring out some of, you know, the benefits that we might be able to, you know, have. And that's been my work. And, you know, I'm not alone in this. There's been, you know, some great guides and teachers, even in my region, that I've learned from. And working with the pawpaw in full sun for full productivity and really exquisite flavor profiles, consistency in its bearing. You know, health and vigor, you know, really kind of working with the genetics and finding, you know, how amazing this pawpaw can be is kind of where I've come, and what really inspired me to write the book as well was to sort of bring to light, so to say, no pun intended there, you know, all these fabulous attributes of the pawpaw and, you know, given the right set of circumstances, how easy and rewarding the pawpaw is. So I don't know, that's another long answer.
That's amazing. I really liked your discussion paralleling the mango, because I can definitely see why it's important when you come back to the United States or come back to North America in the United States, and you're seeing this native fruit and it's being a little bit underutilized. And so I had never heard of the pawpaw until I got involved with the Northern Nut Growers Association about 5 years ago, which is unusual because pawpaws grow native and wild around where I live. And so I'm fascinated by this fruit. And I love learning more about it. So for the audience members who have never seen or tasted a pawpaw, can you describe the taste for us?
It's exquisite. Well, maybe I'll backstep this a little bit and explain, since I had said that this is a tropical relative. So the pawpaw is in the custard apple family, and it's the only member of the custard apple family, which is largely tropical. There's a few subtropical members, but the pawpaw is the only member of that family that has migrated, you know, north into the temperate cold, you know, all the way up into, you know, southern Ontario, and which is phenomenal, you know, which right there says that we're dealing with a very unique adaptive species that has over time, millenniums, you know, on receding glaciers and in the guts of giant sloths and mastodons, you know, migrated as, you know, as the temperatures kept moving and moving to come all the way north. So it literally is a tropical fruit that has adapted and migrated to live up here in our northern woods. There's nothing else like it. There's really no other adaptation story that I know of like the pawpaw as a tropical fruit amongst us wildly here in the north. And when you have a pawpaw, so let's get to that flavor part, right? So there's a spectrum of pawpaw experience. This is also why I wrote the book too, to try and you know, bring out the best experience, ideally from the get-go. So pawpaws do produce where they get some sunlight, right? So pawpaws will grow in the dense shade of the forest as an understory plant. And typically they will only, you know, they'll be a mother plant that suckers, and they'll all be like the children of that mother plant. They're all genetically the same, and they'll create what's called a patch. So you've maybe heard of a pawpaw patch, right? Mm-hmm. So in the understory, you'll get a pawpaw patch, and you know, depending on how much light it gets, it could be anywhere from 6 feet, you know, to 12, 15 feet tall. And if they are isolated and there's only, you know, the mother and their children, they're all genetically the same, they're not going to fruit. They're not going to have sort of the cross-pollination that's needed, the genetic mixing to fruit. And they're going to need sunlight to fruit, right? So, but when that pawpaw migrates out to the edge of the forest, it gets a little lankier and a little taller, 15, 20 feet tall. And as long as it has another sort of genetically different, you know, partner nearby, very nearby, it will set some fruit relative to how much light it gets. And so a lot of people that are experiencing the pawpaw are out, you know, in the fall, you know, in our area, our neck of the woods, it's September, but down south in its region, it could be August, or up north in its region, it could be October. So folks are out walking in the woods, and where there's pawpaws that have enough light and can cross-pollinate, they're finding fruit, right? Sometimes it's on the ground, sometimes it's been there for a few days. And the wild fruit can be very variable, kind of like a crab apple, right? There are good wild crab apples and wild apples out there, but you're going to have to eat quite a few that aren't quite that good until you eat that one. It's the same thing with pawpaw. So if you're out there and you find a pawpaw around here, a lot of folks walk down the CNO canal and they'll find pawpaws. Like, oh, pawpaw, I've heard about a pawpaw. And they pick this pawpaw that's been on the ground for 2 or 3 days, and they open it and they're all excited. They're like, I can't wait to eat the pawpaw. And they, you know, it's like, ugh, it's got bitter notes, it's tannic, and then it's potentially, you know, partly rotten. And they're like, oh my gosh, you know, this isn't anything like what I thought. So unfortunately, that's a lot of people's experience. Whereas it is possible to walk down the CNO canal, see a perfectly ripened fruit on the tree, hand pick it and eat it, and it be sweet and aromatic, not bitter and no tannic touch to it at all. So those kind of glorious pawpaw experiences in the wild do exist. But a lot of times, you know, people will hit a random one and not have the first and best impression. So this is where, you know, working with, you know, cultivating any fruit comes in. But the pawpaw, the story of pawpaw cultivation, you know, is in our culture is, you know, maybe only 100 or so years old of where it's really been worked with and collected and really kind of, you know, intellectually, you know, worked with in the sense of really finding those genetics and, you know, growing them out, cross-pollinating, you know, those great characteristics into fruits. And once they stabilize, you know, creating a cultivar, right? And these cultivars now that can be grown, usually in full sun, are the size of large mangoes. We're talking, you know, some of them are upwards of 2 pounds. I mean, big fruit. And inside that, you open up a pawpaw and it has like a custard, you know, colored flesh, anywhere from sort of a very light yellow to a richer orange. But it's like custard in its consistency, and the flavor is extremely tropical. It is a mix of mango, of banana, of pineapple. You know, I love giving these fruits to people for the first time. I'm like, what do you taste? And people really start just telling me all usually their favorite tropical fruits, because they're just like, oh my gosh, this is taking me to the tropics, or my favorite tropical fruit. And it's not like, oh, maybe it's tropical or yeah. No, it's like, wow, this mm-hmm. is extremely aromatic, very flavorful. The consistency, some people, I mean, I like consistency. Most people do, but I find that there's a texture thing for some folks. But if you like custard and things like that, literally just take a spoon or just eat it, and it just scoops out, and it's like dessert. I mean, it's complete, it's sweet, it's aromatic. I mean, it's really quite an exquisite experience when you have, you know, the good genetics, the good cultivars, and it's properly ripened. So the ripening aspect's another important thing. Another reason I wrote the book too is just to clue in a few of these important things. So the reason that we don't know the pawpaw culturally, you know, more so, is that it's very perishable. It doesn't fit into our modern, you know, industrialized food system. So it doesn't really sit on the shelves in the grocery store. Pawpaw on the tree will stay rock hard. They're green as they're growing and developing, and sometimes they'll stay green all the way through ripening. But a lot of pawpaws will begin to slightly change colors they're ripening, a little bit more yellow. And they will be rock hard until they're starting to ripen and you'll be able to go up, and it's almost like a peach. You just want to, you know, gently squeeze, and if you get some yield, then that pawpaw has begun its ripening. And if you did nothing and you left it on the tree, it would probably fully ripen within 2 days and fall on the ground and begin to, you know, ripen very quickly like a banana. And, you know, within a day and a half on the ground, it would probably be already past, you know, the good eating point. So that's very quick, which is why it's a wonderful tree to grow yourself and go out there and fondle your fruits daily, you know, during the season. And so you go out there. So ideally, yes, you would see, or you can leave it on there another day after you see it starting to yield, let that sun, you know, kiss it and ripen it a little more. And then you can sort of carefully, you know, twist or snip that fruit off, you know, put it in a box, and not even stack the pawpaws on top of each other. That's how gentle you need to be, right? Because wherever they either hit the ground, or if you press too hard, or you start stacking pawpaws on top of pawpaws, they're going to start to bruise. And wherever they bruise, they're going to ripen very quickly. But if they're carefully handled, and this sounds tricky, but it's really not. So if you're careful and thoughtful about your harvest and you bring those pawpaws in, you could put them on your countertop, and, you know, it would be another day or two, you know, until they were, you know, really perfectly ripe. Or you put them in the refrigerator if you handpick them just as they're starting, and they'll stay in the refrigerator for up to a week. But the real saving grace with the pawpaw and its perishability is that it freezes well. So you can pulp them and freeze it, and the pulp will stay good for at least a year. I've pulled stuff out 2 years old that still looks good. So that's the way to sort of capture and keep that harvest, you know. So yeah, I don't know if I answered your question about the flavor. I think it was in there somewhere.
You did.
I just had to give the backdrop.
Yes, and I enjoyed looking through your list of cultivars in your book. My husband and I just moved, and what made me the saddest person about moving, and I almost dug them up to take them with me, is I have two of Jerry Lehman's pawpaws in our yard that I had to say goodbye to. And it was the most heartbreaking thing ever, especially with his passing this year. But I can resonate so well with that story you told, because the first time I had a pawpaw, I was like, oh my goodness, this tastes like a mango. You're right. It just teleports you right to the tropics. And it's so strange to eat this fruit that grew in your backyard in Ohio or Pennsylvania or Virginia or wherever, you know, that just takes you directly there. So that's absolutely amazing. So we've talked a little bit about what the pawpaw is and how it tastes and a little bit about its history. How can you walk through, can you walk us through on if someone would be interested in growing the pawpaw for themselves, how might they go about doing that?
Great question. So yeah, so let's talk about the tree, the pawpaw tree, sometimes called bush. So the pawpaw tree is a beautiful ornamental. I call it an edible landscape all-star. Anything in that category for me is something that is easy to grow, looks good, and is low care. And the pawpaw definitely fits that category, at least in our area. So like I said, when it's grown as a patch, it's kind of, you know, understory, spread out in the woods. On the edge of the woods, it gets a little bit tall and lanky. Bring it out into full sun, and it takes on a beautiful pyramid-shaped tree, anywhere from 15, 12 to, let's say, 12 to 20 feet tall, depending on conditions, and is has these beautiful, like, foot-long, large-lobed green leaves. You know, they're probably easily 6 to 8 inches wide as well. So it's this very tropical look. I mean, sometimes they remind me of the buckeye, you know, the big buckeye leaf, or, you know, magnolia. Anyway, beautiful tropical foliage.
It actually reminds me, the leaf actually reminds me of, in a little bit, and I don't know if the chestnut people will mock me for this, but it reminds me a little bit of a Chinese chestnut leaf, because they are
really
long, and they have the kind of the same darker green color in that elongated shape. But again, I'm not a forester, so I'm pretty sure chestnut farmers are listening to this shaking their head sadly, but you were saying they remind you a little bit of the buckeye leaf. But yeah, they are a beautiful tree. I'm sorry, go ahead and continue. No,
that's okay. I'm a chestnut grower too. I'm not offended. Okay. the Chinese chestnut tends to have, you know, a bit of like a ridged edges to it, but it does have that beautiful deep green look to it. And sometimes you might mistake young hickory trees in the woods for pawpaws, because when they're young, they do have that big lobed leaf that's very similar in pattern. So it's in full sun. It is quite a ornamental tree. And I live on sort of the edge of suburbia here and do a lot of talks to garden clubs, etc. And I really sell the pawpaw on its, you know, its curb appeal. I'm like, this is a really pretty tree to have in your front yard. You know, people are going to be like, ooh, ah, what is that? It's so pretty. And, you know, it doesn't get really nailed by, you know, heavily by insects and disease like a lot of fruit trees do. And then it's hanging with large ripe fruit. I mean, these things to me are very attractive. Okay, so how do you grow a pawpaw tree? So you really don't want to dig a pawpaw up. So it's a good thing you left Jerry's there. You know, you can go back and get some pine wood. Maybe we'll get there about grafting. But
it was actually a provision. And when we did sell the house, I did ask the new owners if I could do that. So I already took care of that. That was my main concern.
Do you like create like an easement, a map, and say I get access to these pawpaws in perpetuity?
Yes, I did.
good move. Smart. Okay, so the pawpaw, like many nut trees, has a taproot that it develops before it even puts up a shoot. So if you're germinating a pawpaw seed, it will send out its root radical, and will oftentimes, if it's free to do so, send that root radical out 9 inches before it ever begins to send up a shoot, which is phenomenal, right? So it's all about the root and the taproot with the pawpaw. If you're familiar with hickories or people listening, it's quite similar. I mean, the hickories gets like, wow, it's like a hickory will have like in the end of the first growing season, like a 2-foot taproot and like literally a 5 or 6 inch top, you know, shoot. And it's just phenomenal. It's just the development of the species. So ideally, you are growing pawpaws from seed versus digging them up. Now, pawpaws can be dug up usually within the first year. 2 years is pushing it, but it's still possible if it's done well. So there are some nurseries that will do bare root pawpaws. And if they're good at what they're doing, it is definitely possible. But if you're not sort of an experienced ninja plants man or woman, I wouldn't start by trying to dig up a pawpaw. That root is very fleshy, very brittle, breaks. It just does not like to be messed with or transplanted. So I am an advocate of, if you're not going to direct seed, so you can direct seed saying, okay, I'm going to grow my pawpaw here and I'm going to create nice conditions and soil and I'm going to put my seed in there. Whether that seed's been stratified by you in the refrigerator, or when you're done eating the pawpaw in the fall, you plant it right then and there.